There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And you are welcome along to the Thursday edition of the Huddle Breakdown. James here with my good friend Alan Morrison from Celtic by Numbers. Hello, Alan. We're going to have a look at yesterday's historic, glorious victory in the Champions League. for a change, we're going to talk a lot about some positives, which is welcome. And I think in fairness, we were, in the grand scheme of the mosaic coming out of Sunday, we were probably on the optimistic side coming out of that as well. But in fairness, yeah, I'm going to take a look at a lot of the positives, look at some context broadly, which, you know, not everything's positive there, obviously. And then we'll have a look ahead here to Hearts on the weekend. So, Alan, first thoughts. I know we haven't had a huge amount of time to dig in. When we do these day afters, we don't have too much time for spreadsheet shagging. So, so we get clouded with too much humanity here. Not enough of our...
Not enough data.
Models, data and models and that boring crap. So what's more of your human impression of what happened yesterday?
I actually have to think of something to say as opposed to be driven by all the data. I mean, just, you know, I usually, when I capture my own data, I do it in two sittings. I'll probably do the first half one day and the second half another day, and it takes about 3 hours for each of those sort of things. Obviously, it's not been time to do that. But you know, there is Opta data available through StatsBomb, which is through FotMob, which is pretty decent, to be fair. You're upbeat, definitely. Really pleased, just pleased, I think, for everybody, actually. You know, the supporters that it looked like at one point, judging by the number of messages I saw on X about people, you know, offering tickets for the match, I thought there was going to be nobody there. But actually, it was a pretty decent crowd. And so pleased for them, pleased for the players, pleased for Brendan Rodgers, actually, as well, to be honest with you. And it was, listen, one of those things we said, you know, if Celtic are going to get anything out of any Champions League game, frankly, because, you know, you're four teams, so we're going to be playing three teams that, even if you might argue in the context of the Champions League, are not very strong, they're incredibly strong in the context of the teams that Celtic habitually have to play in Scotland, of course. So you know, and this one in particular, again, a finer side that I think is, you know, second in Holland, but PSV are like incredible. They've won all their games, I think, in that league. And, yep. You know, we matched them, I think, pretty well. And, you know, we probably got the little bits of luck that you need. And, you know, makes a huge difference in football, a low scoring sport and all that. And you do need to have that. And when I say luck, I mean, you know, they had 19 shots at goal, 8 on target. You know, so Joe Hart made 6 saves. I think one of the saves was by McGregor. You know, so Hart did everything asked of him. So you know that's a lot of pressure. They dominated the ball, possession, etc. They generated over 2 XG. We were actually, you know, 2.27, I think, XG. So it was a bit of a chaotic match in that sense. And we came out on top of it. So listen, that's all great. It wasn't like a sort of we absolutely battered them as we would maybe a Ross County or something like that. But then it's never going to be that. It's always probably going to be a one goal, and we're probably always going to have some element of good fortune fall our way. But that's not, as I say, I don't want to labour the good fortune thing, because if you actually look at the shot XG, so just a reminder, post shot XG is the XG of all the shots that actually make it on target. And so it's a nice stat to use to measure goalkeeping as well. Celtic's post-shot XG was actually 2.64, and Fineriers was only 1.04. So although Hart made, you know, six saves, they weren't actually that many high-quality chances, which is credit to the defence, really, not to give up high-quality chances. So all in all, as I say, chaotic game. We edged it, late goal and all that. And yeah, just really, really happy for everybody.
Yeah, it was one of those games, I the dual-edged sword, right? So it's the dead rubber. We've been here before. I remember the pleasant surprise. I think it was the last game in the Europa League in Ange's first season where we beat Real Betis with kind of an odd lineup. I think that was a nice, that was one of these kind of games too. It was like back and forth, but in a more controlled way than what we talked about coming out of Sunday against Kilmarnock. So this was more, you know, two relatively evenly matched teams that were just playing in a way that was, entertaining. And so it was obviously the fact that we won would have been not nearly as enjoyable had we not gotten that late goal. It would have been a bit deflating given, I'm looking at the match. StatsBomb has a race chart that shows kind of the chances and XG through the game that I know you're familiar with, but we were basically ahead in that virtually the entire game, or even to ahead of it from the 10th minute on until the 85th minute, after they had already tied it, and then they had a kind of a decent chance, one of their better chances. I think it was Jimenez. That was probably Hart's best save. It was a bit angled in that, but it was, pretty good. And he's a good striker, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time they kind of went ahead in the spreadsheet shagging score line. And, it would have been a bit deflating had we ended up with a draw. But yeah, it was one of those games that was actually enjoyable to watch. And it makes you, to me, it makes me, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, sorry to interrupt. Just the, I think if I was going to be disappointed at something, I think it would be when you look at those race charts, or I'm just looking at the FOTMob momentum chart. I love these momentum charts. I think they're quite, and actually they almost correlate exactly with the packing score charts. By the way, just I'll throw that one in. My concern was that Celtic didn't respond well either to taking the lead or when they equalised, and they Feyenoord's greatest moments of momentum and pressure were immediately after Celtic scored up to half time, and then immediately after they equalised, almost until the point that Lagerbielte scored the goal. So we didn't respond well to going ahead or to being pegged back, and that would be a little bit of a concern to me, that we were a bit stronger in those moments just after a goal scored.
Yeah, and that to me is probably I'm just vamping on what you said here. That's where I think you get the confluence of athleticism with intensity can create kind of surges, meaning that they seem to respond, and I would say on balance their athletic profile kind of man to man was probably a little better than ours. It's not a shock. So they, particularly in like midfield, I mean, they got some big, fast dudes that play in there that would get beyond our players and then just accelerate with the ball, which obviously is not the easiest thing to do in midfield. I think those were periods when they kind of took it up a notch or two, kind of like what we saw with Kilmarnock in the second half on Sunday. Obviously, totally different scale of player and athlete, but so I agree with you. I mean, that's one of these latent issues that I think is probably not going to go away. Fortunately, won't have to deal with it as much domestically. And that goes back when I say relatively well matched. I mean, one of the things I wrote about when we got this group was highlighting how both Lazio and Feyenoord probably overperformed last season. And that perception of how good they were heading into this group was probably artificially high because of those things. And that, Feyenoord was a pretty weak on a grand, in the grand scheme of things, a pretty weak pot one team. But that's, you know, so the good part of that is I think, you know, when we were playing 11 v 11 in this group, we didn't look out of sorts. I thought we, you know, looked right in line with where we should. And that leaves the addressable issues of upgrading quality and players. You know, I think is another positive coming out of the game is kind of a reaffirmation of some of the things that we've been talking about during the group stage here. Well, let's talk about some, anything else on kind of the high level stuff on the game before we get into some of the individual player performances.
I don't think so. I think, just to finish off on that point about reacting to goals, we did see that again. We did see that at the weekend against Kilmarnock. We didn't respond well to either of the Kilmarnock goals, actually. So maybe this is just something that I don't know whether it's a mentality thing or what, but you normally expect to see Celtic, especially a goal again, is respond in quite an aggressive manner. So I hope something that's been talked about is in terms of how the team mentally, you know, recalibrate themselves if something like that happens. Excuse me.
Yep. So let's get into some of the performances then. I think the, you know, obviously kind of a first thing is, you know, for Mitchell Frame to make his debut, that's quite a thrill, I would suspect, for, I think he's 17, soon to be 18, I think I saw in the not too distant future. So that's something so that's something just really cool. I mean, it wasn't he had a part to play in the second goal. So that, I think that was really cool. You know, again, just from the human side of it, Lagerbilka, I'm sure, has been living a certain reality in recent months, given his move and inability to get into squad and to play, and for him to get on and to enjoy, you know, scoring the winning goal. I think that's really cool too. So those are kind of my first, just two human highlights. But from a performance perspective, I mean, you know, I think you and I have been well above consensus on Stephen Welsh for a long time now. And I thought he was outside of one kind of, and this goes back to the old issue of confirmation bias. He certainly had one doozy on the passing side, but outside of that, which fortunately didn't turn into anything horrible. But outside of that, I thought he was quite good in the game. What did you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, again, context being thrown in, hasn't played since August, didn't expect him to play, to be honest with you, didn't even know he was going to be in the squad. I mean, this is kind of supporting Ender's point, which I kind of rebutted really earlier in the week, where about, you know, surprising changes, if you like you say, where did Mitchell Frame come from in terms of getting time, throwing Lagerbielka in, etc. So, you know, yeah, that was there were definitely some little surprises there. You know, starting a Champions League game with Welsh and Scales as your centre backs is something. Well, you know, we thought we'd never say, but then it just harks back to, you know, the times when we started with Bitton and AN other in central defence in the Champions League qualifier, doesn't it? I mean, we haven't.
Remember
Ewan?
Was it Ewan O'Connell? O'Connell, wasn't it?
with Bitton. So listen, what I will say about Scales and Welsh, and again, listen, I've not watched the game back yet, so I've not really studied, you know, their positioning, decision-making, what have you. I'm just going by the general performance stats and so forth, and my general view from the game last night, which was that they both did really well, and they absolutely, I'm sure that will be borne out. But I think, you know, again, listen, trying to be balanced, we have to remember, I think what we've seen with Scales, and I'm really thinking about going back to Ibrox here, is that he's a defender who probably comes into his own when he's asked to defend, right? You know, have him backed up to the 18-yard line, have him having to deal with boss, you know, crosses being chucked in or what have you. You know, he's a pretty good defender, actually, and he does a pretty good job. The concern is more around, you know, can he play as a ball-playing centre-back in an expansive football playing side when he's at the halfway line for half the game, more than half the game type of thing. That's really the question mark. But I thought, you know, as I say, almost a sort of last ditch defender type of performance, he was absolutely excellent. And I'm really pleased for him in that sense. Even, you know, and Greg Taylor, I thought, put in a good shift. Joe Hart, I thought, was was a bit more than just competent. He done good as well. So yeah, I thought there were some really good strong defensive moments there. I think to your point, it looked very easy to me for them to kind of pass through our midfield. That they seemed to be able to do that at pace and get through very quickly on a number of occasions. Now, you know, that, again, I think that probably just comes back to the athleticism deficit that we've talked about. I mean, they essentially had two sort of pseudo kind of wingers, really, but they at times they had kind of five in midfield there, and we had the sort of more of the three, and if O'Reilly was pushed up, then it was two. So it just felt a little bit like we're overpowered in that part of the field at times. But you know, fortunately, and a lot of those times they did result in shots. But as I say, I think where the defense did well was just in basically manning the ramparts and stopping incursions. You know, there weren't that as many for all the shots they had. There wasn't as many incursions into the really dangerous areas. Although FotMob claims they had five big chances and we had three. I'm not. The XG doesn't seem to support that so much, but I'll have a look at that myself when I go through the game. So yeah, listen, defensive. I think the defense deserves a lot of credit, and it probably suited, you know, especially the centre backs. It probably suited their style of play.
Yeah, I think in the grand scheme of things, that's probably a relative strength of Welsh and Scales, is that kind of recovery speed. You know, I don't think either of them are speed demons, but I think they're at least competent in that regard. And we were, I think, pretty well organized in that kind of transition recovery and getting into positions that we needed to. The one thing I will say is, and this is in honor of our dear friend Enda, who's not with us today, is a shout out to Liam Scales for the dark arts, because I think you know, he probably deserves credit for earning that penalty, winding that guy up in the box before he got the sickle, whatever that was, iron sickle neck grab that he ended up suffering when that guy lost the plot. So, congratulations to Liam Scales for doing something. I, you know, that's not something that we quantify or look at, but it has been a criticism that I've heard at times that maybe our players haven't been as skilled in the dark arts at times, particularly when we play teams like Atletico Madrid and, you know, some of these teams that are a little bit more opportunistic, shall we say, in some of this stuff.
I was stunned. I didn't, you know, I was watching it and going, they give penalties for that? Really?
Yeah, I thought at first I thought he went in for a kiss and a romantic embrace, and that Scales pulled away, but it just looked like a drag down. So good on Liam Scales for earning that. As far as the other players, you know, I'd say obviously Scales, Taylor. I mean, not really the defense. I mean, to your point, I mean, there weren't any outside of a couple of close calls. There were no hair-raising mistakes. And against a team like that, when we talk about this relative to domestic versus Europe and how much more we pay and suffer when making those kind of mistakes. And it's not as if they were impotent relative to the press. I mean, so I thought we actually handled their press reasonably well, right? So again, it's within mm-hmm. context. So I think the other part of this is, yeah, there was some fine margins where, you know, Kyogo was very close on a couple of occasions, and we just didn't quite get them the ball in positions. And, you know, I think that continues to be a latent issue that we've been dealing with and discussing. But and any other standouts for you before we maybe get into some of the legacy challenging issues, why we shouldn't get too excited about this, obviously?
Well, do you want to go through some of the other players? Just, I mean, I think, you know, but I think McGregor was excellent, actually, I thought, throughout the game. I think it was one of those games where, I don't know if you do this, but when I watch a game and then I see who's got the ball, and I almost have like a a different response depending on who the ball goes to. So, like, you know, yep. O'Reilly gets the ball, and I'm like, oh, thank God for that. You know, maybe somebody else might get the ball and be like, oh no, what's going to happen now, sort of thing. You know, but it was one of those nights where I just felt every time McGregor got the ball, I kind of felt sort of warm and safe. I kind of felt that, oh, that's good. McGregor's got the ball. We'll be fine. It was kind of one of those performances. He just seemed to kind of settle everybody and just play really sensibly and in a very kind of controlled sort of manner. I mean, I know these are all kind of quantitative things I'm talking about there on that, but I'm just remembering how I felt when I watched the game as opposed to responding to any of the particular data. But yeah, that was my abiding sort of feeling really of his performance. I think on the other side of it, you know, again, Palmer was good, but again, I'm getting increasingly frustrated that, you know, and this is where I'm going to sound like a really old school kind of non-analytical person, is that
screaming at clouds again, Alan.
Well, I don't want this to become an easy trope, right? And then there's a risk of that, and I apologize if it becomes it. I don't want it to, but you know, you compare Palmer last night, a full Celtic Park crowd, big game, big pitch, etc., big noise and all that sort of thing, and you know, he does pretty well compared to almost abject display in the rain on the plastic at Kilmarnock. And you sort of think, mate, you've got to do it like McGregor. You've got to do it every week, not just turn up in the games you fancy it. And that's an awful and lazy trope that I've applied there, but I'm just responding to the ups and downs of his performances. I know you're going to get ups and downs with wingers, but it does seem to be that it's feast or famine with him. You know, he's either in the game and he's at it and he's making things happen, or you get very little out of him. And then talking of which, you know, dear old Mikey Johnson, that's another start. You know, XG plus XA 0.07. Now, and this unfortunately is the trend, right? And what we're talking about, again, lazy trope, you know, lack of output, lack of productivity in the final third. He's very good. He's excellent. Give him the ball on the halfway line, a la, you know, Ryan Kent, he'll take you up the pitch, but then get to the edge of the box, what happens? Right? That's the problem. It needs to be, and this actually was a, you know, Ryan Kent thing as well. Ryan Kent was excellent. Get you up the pitch. And these sorts of players do have massive utility in Europe. There is a lot to be said for simply having someone take you 40 yards up the pitch. It just relieves the pressure. It allows you, your whole team to push up. You can get back into shape. It makes them run backwards and all that, right? It's a really good thing when you're playing against a better opponent, especially. But if he's one of your three forwards, you know, and it's asking a lot, he's doing that great job of being the ball carrier. But yeah, you've got to do something when you get to the edge of the box. You've got to either create or have a credible shot. And you know, four games now, we're just not seeing that. And I do wonder how long. I know we're in a bad place as regards choices on the wing at the moment, and probably Johnson's the better of the options that are available. But you know, he has to start producing. He has to start creating, you know, credible chances and, you know, having credible shots at goal, not stupid attempts from out wide that sail over the bar or get blocked immediately and all that kind of stuff. So that was the kind of slight kind of moan, I suppose, if you want to put it that way. But otherwise, and again, Bernardo, absolute enigma to me. Again, hopefully I'm proven wrong, but I don't remember him playing a single forward pass. It's just incredible. I've never seen a player like that. You know, he's great off the ball. He's robust. He's athletic. He gets about the field. He gets the ball and it always goes backwards. It's like literally two packing passes all season. I mean, that's Joe Hart had more than that against St. Johnson. Joe Hart played about four packing passes against St. Johnson, against Kilmarnock, sorry. So that is astonishing for an attacking, you know, ostensibly an attacking midfielder. So, but I like him. There's a lot I like about him. But again, he's going to have to produce more in the final third and be more creative, I think.
So I view player level single game OBV similar to single game XG at the team level.
You know, absolutely, it's kind of like, absolutely.
Right. So it's contextual. Yeah. It can help paint a picture, but take it with a huge grain of salt. But it does oftentimes align with, you know, your packing scores and that kind of stuff relative to like pass OBV. And just to people that are listening or watching, that's it, it's basically like a possession based model how does each action on the pitch, both from a pass, defensive, dribble and carry, shot, and then what the goalkeeper's doing, not just shot stopping, but sweeping and coming for claims and parrying the ball. All that stuff gets factored into this one model. And does each action, how does it increase your chances of scoring a goal? Or conversely, the net change relative to the opposition scoring, right? So it's this big aggregated model that breaks all this stuff down. So again, single game, very much grain of salt, but it's interesting. So if you look at defensive action OBV, for example, so that basically how impactful were the collective of the actions that various players took to defend, Bernardo was 0.26. Now again, that's prorated to a full game. That's not, you know, just his amount of minutes on the pitch. So he was very, while he was on, he was very, go ahead.
Sorry, James, I was going to say, just to really dumb it down a bit here, because I'm getting my head around. 0.26 is high. I just want to
yes.
say that. Yeah, 0.26 is a high number. Yeah.
Yeah, the highest defensive action person that Feyenoord had was 0.13 for context, right? So this goes down to, you know, and again, actions are not off the ball, but, you know, so again, it's a tool. It's a way of looking at certain things. So Callum McGregor's was 0.22, Liam Scales was 0.22, and Stephen Welsh was 0.32. Right. So this goes back to this issue. Now, by definition, the way the model works, making a tackle at the 18 is going to count a lot more in this counting model than a counter press at the midway line. Right. Just by proximity of probability of scoring a goal. You can't score from, you know, normally from 50 yards. So that's going to count less than if you make an action. So we were defending more, but within that kind of our own final third, we did a very good job on ball in defending. And to your point, so Bernardo was not only good in his kind of normal spatial and movement. I agree with that. He looked at, but even on ball, I mean, but his pass OBV was negative 0.12. Right. So again, this goes back to this.
Really bad.
Well, right. So if you think about it, you know, he completes those safe passes that don't really help us score goals directly. I think a part of a broader buildup. But, you know, when there was a more aggressive, you either misplace some of those and or when you try to be more adventurous, turn the ball over. And that's how you end up with kind of a negative score, so to speak. So that speaks to, you know, just for people watching, that's the kind of thing that we can look at to use statistics to kind of paint a picture as far as what's been going on in a game. But it also speaks to, you know, how well are we collectively defended? Because one of the concepts I use analytically is pervasiveness or diffusion, meaning that you're more robust when you have a bunch of things doing well together. And I think that was, you know, kind of reflected.
The opposite of toxic combinations, in other words.
Exactly. You're exactly right. Well, let's then maybe step back and take a look at the broader picture then for the campaign. So real quick, I did a thread in its importance of putting yesterday in the context, dead rubber, neither team really having, quote unquote, anything to play for. We were both kind of locked into European slots. So we've kind of gone through a lot of the positives. So the one of the contextual negatives, and I did a thread on it before the game, and I updated everything. I had written back in May, and just kind of continually that, you know, not doing something at the keeper level would be unforgivable relative to our stated goal of advancing and progressing in Europe or making improvements. And I take no joy in reporting that Joe Hart ended up with the 32nd out of 32 teams in shot stopping in the group stage collectively. And again, he was okay yesterday, right? But he had been so poor on an aggregated basis. And if you kind of take the overall goalkeeping, if you include claims, positional errors, and all this other stuff, pairing and everything else, he was only eclipsed by one keeper who was worse. See if you can guess who that might have been, Alan. He's made a lot of news in the – he's been quite an object of derision.
The Manchester United guy.
Yeah, poor Onana. He's had a real rough time of it this season. His shot stopping was marginally better than Hart's, but he had some really bad overall keeper play above and beyond that. So he was 32nd in overall goalkeeper OBV, and Hart was 31st. So that unfortunately, and that's what I put in my thread. If you look at, you know, I would argue that outside of and obviously, I mean, this is contextual. It's counterfactual. So that caveat ahead of time. But if you looked at when we were playing 11v11, you know, because when you're playing in just six games and large portions of two games were with 10, 9, and 10 men, that skews things quite a bit. And if you just look at our 11v11 minutes, we were right in range of teams like Copenhagen this season, like Bruges last season, Club Bruges, even like a couple of other clubs this season that, you know, did okay in the group, still finished third, dropped down in the Europa League. And really the one of the big changes between who slots in which one of those groups is keeper play. And obviously, when you're talking about just six games, even good keepers, like I don't think Onana is one of the worst keepers in the world. You know, he's one of these guys who's probably pretty talented, decent keeper, and it's just not working for him at Manchester United. And he had an awful, you know, six games. But this was not the first. Like, if you slot Hart contextually, his time before he got the Celtic, and then how he's done in the league, and you benchmark that, and then how he did in Europa last season's Champions League. This is not, I would argue, an aberration that this came out of nowhere. So that was an unfortunate validation of a big risk that you and I have talked about for months, literally on end. And I think it's the elephant in the room for the group. Because I, even given all of the nightmare that we've dealt with the transfer window, the injuries, I think if we would have had a competent European level keeper, we very likely could have won the Lazio game that we lost at home, and maybe even you end up with another point somewhere in there. And that, again, that could have been good enough for second in this group, as bad as Lazio was, and as kind of mediocre as Feyenoord is within the context of a first seed, or first pot, I should say.
Yeah. That's a great job. And I'm not surprised about that. I'm a little bit surprised that Hart comes out as low as that. I think he, whereas, you know, I go back to that opening goal in Rotterdam. I mean, that just almost, it doesn't kill the campaign dead, but it just set the tone of a competent, organized, sensible performance being undone by a known risk. It was just very galling. I thought he kind of got a little bit stronger as the campaign went on. So a little bit surprised he's at the bottom there, but you know, I know your methodology is thorough. So that's interesting. And like you say, backs up what we were saying at the beginning. I think it would have been a stretch. I do feel, you know, certainly last year was a massively missed opportunity, not being able to be one place higher than Shakhtar. And similarly, I'm feeling the same, that we should have been capable of being one place higher than either Lazio or Feyenoord in this group.
With all of these issues, that's the crazy part.
Even with all these issues, yeah. I just felt, you know, especially in Rome, for example, where again, for 80 minutes, we, whilst not in any shape or form dominating, there was a level of control, a level of comfort in the game. But we never carried enough threat, because we had Forrest and was it Palmer, I think, on the wings, etc. And we just never, and Bernardo, who, you know, again, has got his strengths, bolstering the attacking final third productivity isn't one of them. So, you know, that's a lot of, you know, when you don't have a Moy stroke Hitati, when you don't have a Jota, when you don't have an Abada, suddenly that's a huge amount of attacking final third productivity you're taking out of the team. So even though I honestly feel that we were well coached, our approach was well, I know the football wasn't thrilling, but it was sensible, it was pragmatic, it was the right approach for the standard of the teams that we were playing. I do feel we should have deserved to get enough to at least be one place higher. We didn't. That's the way it goes. Champions League football is tough, etc. And people may disagree with that. That's fine. But I was kind of, I suppose, satisfied with the way that we approached it. But again, there wasn't a single game where you say, okay, this is the best 11 that he could put out, and we carry a bit of threat here. We're going to score a goal tonight. You know what I mean? Every game it felt like, oh, it's another patch-up job. And, well, as long as they work hard and keep to plan, they might be okay. We'll stay in the game. And that's pretty much how it was. And then we kind of got undone by maybe a little bit of quality later in the game. So, yeah, that's kind of, I don't know, rambling a bit, but that's kind of my thoughts on that, really. It was sort of, I think my conclusion would be I just did a decent job with a bad hand, I would say.
100%, and I think that's it's funny how mood swings in just a couple of days, depending on the two results. You know, quite the contrast Sunday and then yesterday. So and the relevant aftermaths. The other thing I'll say is, you know, we are hypercritical at times. And we talk about being the best version of ourselves as a kind of the aspirational goal generally. And obviously that's, I think, the kind of mindset that we share relative to Celtic. But, you know, there's a lot of teams that are pretty mediocre, even at the Champions League level. And when I say that, meaning that they're not running, you know, we talk about some of these clubs like Alkmaar and, you know, Bodo Glimt and Salzburg kind of endlessly, aspirationally, and some of the things that they've been doing, Atalanta, you know, there's been different ones in different ways in recent years. But, you know, in any given season, as we saw with Rangers and their run in the Europa League, as you see with Club Brugge or Copenhagen now, I mean, by definition, you're going to have these kind of clubs, that aren't world beaters, that aren't being run by rocket scientists, that, you know, just because they're reasonably competent or they have a talent cycle. Like I said, that's kind of the way I viewed Feyenoord, who have not been one of the more progressively run clubs, even within the Dutch league. And, you know, they just have a really good positive talent cycle. Now, maybe they've eclipsed some things and innovated and, you know, some of these latent things, maybe they've been upgrading and doing some certain stuff, but there hasn't been a pattern of that in recent history. And they just have some really good talent right now. And clubs kind of go through those ebbs and flows of talent cycles, even Benficas and the Portos of the world that have a veritable pipeline, it seems, of talent and development. You know, we've seen it with Salzburg kind of go through ebbs and flows with talent and cycles. So I think that's the hope in all of this, is that even all of the stuff that we're critical about and, you know, hope and talk about improvements, some of these changes can be really material and get us into a point of, you know, and I think that's kind of been the de minimis step, is to get to a point of relevancy, where we don't all kind of look towards the European campaign and this bifurcated, like, delusional dreams of grandeur that are completely displaced from any reasonableness, versus like just as soon as reality smacks us in the head after the first game in the Champions League, we're back into this, you know, the other extreme of misery and you know, hypercritical. So I that's the thing I take away from it, is, you know, I think we're both reasonably skeptical as far as until they prove it, prove some adeptness in recruitment, but it shouldn't be that difficult to do some of these relatively basic things to get us right into that point of relevancy. So to me, that's the ultimate positivity. I mean that, you know, we've done enough here, given what the hand that we were dealt coming out of August, that, you know, maybe we're torturing ourselves by having that sliver of hope, but I still have it.
I mean, let's be brutally honest. If I was the chairman or the CEO, and I'm marking the end of year scorecard, we failed, right? The goal was to be playing some form of European football after the new year, and we failed. So, as far as I'm concerned, that at the corporate level, the club failed. Okay, the football operation has failed to achieve a target, right? What I would then say is, you know, well, why did you fail? Personally, if you'd given me an equivalent squad to what Ange had last year, I would have expected to achieve that goal. But we clearly didn't have a squad that's as equivalently strong as we had last year. And that's the reason. It's what it comes down to. That's the reason. I think but also more subtly, if you had to pick on one self-inflicted thing, it would be the goalkeeper. Yeah, it would be the goalkeeper. So yeah, we failed, but there's good reasons why we failed, which I think are acceptable, if you like, if you know what I mean.
And in the grand scheme of the modern industry, should be relatively low hanging fruit to make huge improvements on. Like, it shouldn't be this difficult to go from, you know, relatively dreadful recruiting to even mediocre recruiting. like I would argue we were under Ange, for you know, different reasons, but. You know, a level of competency and even coherence that's reaches kind of minimum levels of mediocrity would be a significant improvement. And again, I think that would have been put us right in there. And now the flip side of this is next year, you know, let's assume hopefully we win the league, and even with the new Champions League for next season, we make it a horrible draw and do everything right, or even improve on a lot of the stuff. Oh, yeah. And end up failing on the KPIs. Oh, yeah.
Luck plays its part. Right. Yeah, luck plays its part. Yeah, yeah.
Yep, yep. Such is the torture of life. Well, let's stick a pin in that then, and let's do a couple of minutes here just looking ahead to Hearts on the weekend, just to kind of set the stage. You had referenced coming out of the, for context in that defeat to Kilmarnock. Kilmarnock is actually third in non-penalty XG difference in the league so far this season, which again, I think is a credit to them. They're the only other team outside of Rangers and South. It's modest, but I will give them credit. They're the only other one that has a positive non-penalty XG differential. Yes, and Hearts are fourth, kind of clustered with Aberdeen. And then you go down to Hibs and Dundee.
So James, just different models, different result. Bot Mob actually has Hearts terrible, like a 0.49 negative XG difference, and that would basically they're on a par with Motherwell, and worse than nearly as bad as Ross County actually. Fot Mob Opta does not like Hearts at all.
Yeah, and I think part of that, I'd be interested in what the disaggregation on that between for and against is that's where I think StatsBomb's model relative to non-Celtic Rangers teams are vital because of the amount of chances that are aerial and their model accounting for where the ball is, basically. Was it actually a decent header chance, or was it, you know, the guy flailing and it just glanced off of him, and it's assigned, you know, a relatively inaccurate probability. I think now I'll filter this. You ready for this magic filter? And I'm going to go for the away filter. So we're just going to look at, because I do think that's something that historically, it's not too much this year, but they're still third in a way this year. So that's in prior seasons, it's been more skewed for them. So some live analysis here on the Huddle breakdown. Whereas at Tynecastle, historically, they've been a little bit more skewed positive, and then on the road negative. So that's interesting. Actually, they're almost in line home and away this season. So what one would think, and at this our away net penalty XG difference is only about one, which, you know, again, that's, you and I have been harping on about that forever now, that that's gets you firmly in the Tom Cruise Maverick danger zone, highway to the danger zone, in dropping points. So that that's validated by looking at that, but fortunately we're at home. So, you know, generally speaking, the way Hearts have been playing and the way we've been playing would be optimistic. But again, this is going to be a litmus test, I think, given coming out of this relatively feel-good performance and result yesterday. This really should be a game that we handle pretty comfortably, in my judgment anyway. What's your view?
Yeah, I mean, Hearts, again, you're looking at stats, but I'm looking at Opta. They've got the biggest differential between actual goals conceded and expected goals conceded, meaning they've not conceded that many goals, but they expect, but they should have conceded an awful lot more. It's almost like 0.5 per game.
Yep.
Which means that, you know, there might be some that maybe not quite as defending as well as, it could mean many things, right? It could be poor finishing, good luck, the goalkeeper maybe having some good performances, etc. So it could be all those things. But you know, in general, that trend won't last. Well, generally, won't last forever. You'd expect them to, if they keep conceding that amount of XG of over 1 point, you know, the 1.6 a game, you're going to expect them to concede some goals at some point if that carries on. So listen, I mean, you know, I do think they are a team that seem to be performing well below the sum of the parts. Meaning, you know, they've got, you know, a fairly solid set of decent players. And, you know, I don't think they're performing as well as that group would be. Even the much vaunted Shankland, you know, I know he's got 7 goals in the league this season. Probably a few of those are penalties. Haha. you know, his XG is, I think, 5.89, and he's scored 7, etc. You know, he's not getting as many chances. Boyce doesn't seem to be the same player he was post his ligament injury, and he's getting into his mid-30s. In any case, the midfield is incredibly one-paced. It's a very sort of pedestrian midfield. You know, whether it's, you know, I know Devlin's not been playing much, but Neuendorf, I think it is, that plays in there. And out wide, they're struggling for consistency, whether it's Forrest, whether it's Lowry, whether it's Spargas, whether it's Oda. You know, it's a revolving cavalcade of, a bit like Celtic actually at the moment, a revolving cavalcade of wingers, wide forwards that they can't seem to kind of settle on and get a consistent tune out of. So, you know, if you look at Hearts this season in all competitions, they've won as many as they've lost, really. And that probably isn't good enough given their budget and the players that they've got. So I think they're an underperforming team. And I'll say the same thing as I said before the Hibs home game, which is, I'm much less worried about this than I was about the Kilmarnock game. And I'm sure that could slap me in the face, of course. But generally speaking, you know, we're at home again. It makes a huge difference, I think. And as I say, I think under Naismith, I predict they will continue to be an underperforming team, frankly.
Yeah, this is a class. I agree with everything you just said there, particularly the comparison with Kilmarnock away. And this is where if a team of Hearts level comes in and, you know, kind of plays a hybrid of, as we called it, the St. Mirren model last season, that's when I start to get a little more nervous. If they look to optimize and being really defensive and, you know, basically rely on a couple of counterattack high ball or set piece kind of chances to, and really go out setting to play for a 0-0 draw. That's the kind of situation that makes me more nervous as far as dropping points. But I suspect that's, I think, you know, just based off of how they've played so far this season and what I've seen from the manager, it's more likely to be a Hibs model that we just saw. And I'm hoping for that. Cause again, it makes the game more entertaining. As you had said, I mean, their midfield's not something, particularly if they're going to be a little bit more expansive. And it doesn't even have to be crazy expansive. It's, you know, somewhat expansive. Create that space where we can capitalize on it. So, yeah, let's hope so. Then I think we have a week off then. I don't think there's a midweek game. And then we get into the avalanche of the crush round the festive period, which we will probably be back at least once a week. We'll see, maybe twice a week, depending on how schedules align. I know Alan and Ender are big partiers around the Christmas and New Year's period. I still don't think. Yeah, I'm still recovering from the hogmanay I spent in Scotland from 2000 into 2001 when I was a young man. I'm still recovering from that experience. So, but yeah, we'll make sure we're present. Yep, go ahead.
Sorry, just to finish off, Jane, because, you know, I don't normally do this, but, you know, partly this is my blog, my podcast, so I feel like it's my platform to say something. So, but no, what I want to get to is you put out a really, really excellent, actually, tweet today.
You sound surprised. You're flattering me with faint praise.
I'm mentioning it because it's such a, obviously, a momentous occasion. And you know, check it out. James's tweet is in relation to Graham Spears putting on his Patreon site free for everybody the ramblings of a certain individual. I'm not even going to name, actually. All related to the Spears podcast that I was on, talking about you know, refereeing bias in Scottish football. Now, so what I would like to say for myself is, having read what was on that site, which I hadn't been aware of until it went up, because the individual concerned is somebody I have blocked, right? So I don't like blocking people, and I used to take a very kind of laissez-faire attitude towards it. But you know, as your kind of reach does grow and you get more followers and so forth, more that kind of slightly naive view that I had kind of is shown to be unrealistic. So you know, but I've got some pretty easy rules that I follow around these things. So, you know, if you're racist, if you're a sectarian, if you're sexist, if you weaponize child abuse, if you abuse anybody on my timeline, it's an instant block and there's no second chance and that's it. I don't mind debate. I don't mind people disagreeing with me, as long as you keep it in good faith. If you're in bad faith, I'll probably mute you, and I'll probably unmute you at some point in the future. That's my basic rules. That's it. This individual I've had blocked for some time. I suspect for many of the reasons that I've just outlined. In the post that's up on Graham Spears' site, which I don't encourage you to read, it appears to me, and this is how I feel, that I was threatened in that post, and that's clearly unacceptable. Graham Spears, I've spoken to him about this. He won't take it down. So this is where we are. So listen, I'm happy to debate all the points raised on that podcast in good faith, with sensible people, with serious people, not with internet fucking lunatics. So that's really my position on that, that's what I've said to Graham. I'm happy to come back on a show if he's got, you know, proper people to actually debate with. Now, the reason I mentioned all of this is because actually the most sensible and challenging comment that I've received on all of this was from my good friend James here. So I wanted to give James the opportunity really to make some points about the approach, what he heard, what I've done. And bear in mind, I've not yet written down my analysis and my methodology and all that, right? And that's on me, and I will do that. The reason that I haven't done that yet is because I'm cogitating about where to put that, but I will do it. I promise you all that will happen. But anyway, listen, James is familiar with some of this stuff, but I wanted to give you the chance, James, because you actually came up with some of the best sort of challenging comments about it all. So I wanted to only fair that you got a chance to kind of air those.
Yeah, so these are not necessary. These are inherent. So my comment was relative to what was written on Spears's Patreon. In, you know, I had a, you know, I have several, not even several, a number of smart, typically, you know, analytically inclined Rangers supporters that I have Twitter relationships with, that I DM with, you know, is what they're outnumbered, by the way, before I have my blue shirt. My daughter goes to the University of Pittsburgh, by the way, so that's why I have my blue shirt on. You know, they're vastly outnumbered by my friends and connections with Celtic, but you know, so I had some, you know, interactions this morning about some of this, which kind of kicked me off, that made me respond the way I did, because I went to the Spears' Patreon to read it, and the, and look, one of the comments I made to one of these people is that, you know, because again, you have to remember I come from this background professionally, and if I had somebody offer this level of analysis up independent of the content to me, I mean, if they were looking for a job, I either wouldn't hire them, or if that work product was given to me, they wouldn't be around very long. And it's again, independent of the topic, it was just, you know, logical fallacies and ad hominem and kind of just sporadic all over the place. And a lot of techniques that are used to, and I'm not above this at times, I've done it in the past, you know, there's always the argument of doing the greater good, that kind of thing, but persuasive writing rather than analytical writing. And, you know, having done this for as long as I can, reasonably adept at identifying the difference. So my response was more so like, if you were going to have a good faith, third party, objective criticism, or at least an angle of criticism, it would be about things like sample size, meaning that we're dealing with a time frame here that's, you know, not huge. I mean, I think it's you know, and let's go back to basic statistics, you know, fun things like p-value and error bars and, you know, confidence intervals, that kind of stuff. So by definition, the smaller your sample size, you know, you want as big as possible. And he weaponized that. So this is a good example, right? So you can take things that are a reasonable analytical concept. And what I would argue he did is weaponize that incoherently, meaning that you laid out a very cogent, logical explanation as to why you came up. It wasn't an arbitrary endpoint, which is another huge analytical faux pas, you know, people do with chart crimes and all these other things that they do when they're writing persuasively. As opposed to kind of, you know, good faith strides at objectivity. I thought your explanation and why you selected the time frame that you did, it's all about incentives. It was all coherent, all made sense to me. You can disagree with it, but that's the debate to have, is why. Why would you say that this is illogical or doesn't make sense or is unfair, right? That's, I think, a fair playground, right? That's if you're going to have an honest intellectual debate and discussion, okay, then you do it on those grounds. You don't weaponize something and misapply. So that's what I saw in what was done on the Patreon. So I think it's reasonable. And then within that context, if you take that timeline and the incentive structure that you lay out is reasonable, okay, well then what are the methodologies? And I think a reasonable criticism would be, okay, sample size isn't large enough. What does large enough mean? Again, that's where you get into subjectivity. But that's combated by, you know, when you have multiple signals, this is extracting signal from noise and patterns, right? But that also introduces a second potential pathway of criticism would be, this is a constant issue of people that live in analytics. This is a big problem with machine learning that's going on. I see it in financial markets all the time that are increasingly controlled, I would argue manipulated by quants, is the flaw of correlation versus causation. And correlations are not stable through time necessarily. And even ones that have a seemingly logical relationship, that may not be actual causation. It may be correlation. I'm not saying that that's the case in this circumstance. I'm saying that is an inherent, by definition, risk of doing any kind of statistical analysis. And if someone's going to have a good faith criticism of the type of analysis that you're putting out, that would be a pathway that someone could do serious work, serious breakdown, and say, this is a serious argument that contradicts what you've put forth. So that's kind of what I was saying, because I haven't done that work yet. So as we talked about before we went live, I'm getting sucked into this abyss. I've been wanting to stay out of it, but I'm going to do a little bit of digging for myself here, because now my curiosity's really peaked, and with our friendship and relationship, I'm like, all right, I'm going to put some time into this.
Just for people's benefit, one of the things that came up actually, which I agree with, again on the Patreon, it was misrepresented. It ignored the fact that I'd explained it extensively on my site, and all that good faith stuff just wasn't present. But never mind. Well, listen. So one of the I don't want to get too much in the detail, but just one point, just to make clear to people that, you know, we're trying to do this. It's never going to be objective in the sense of I'm a Celtic fan, James is a Celtic fan. But the idea is to make it robust enough that somebody who is objective would at least say, yep, I agree with your methodology. It makes sense what you're trying to do. Your assumptions are reasonable. Your sample size is reasonable. Your scope is reasonable. And the way that you've applied it and you've come to logical conclusions. That's what I'm aiming for, right? Accepting I'm a Celtic fan. So it does mean trying to sort of think outside of that framework. So anyway, one of the things was part of the framework that I use in terms of what is the impact of a decision is around red cards. Now, what I use at the moment, and I've said this multiple times, I've said it on my site, I've said it in my framework document that explains what the methodology is. I've been very open about it, I think. It is a very, very blunt instrument. Right. It basically, I based it on an article which I've linked to. It's public, which worked out, I think, in the English Premier League, maybe, that if you have a player sent off for the home side, it reduces the number of points they get on average by about 0.86. And if somebody gets sent off for the away side, it's on average, it's about 0.36 or something like that. Anyway, what it doesn't do, it doesn't take any account of at what stage in the match it is. It's an average. So, you know, if you get sent off in the first minute versus the 90th, clearly that's going to have a much, much different effect. And so I've been using this blunt instrument openly, been very open about it. But I accept that for red cards, that may well skew, because they don't happen that often, right? So it is quite a small sample size to this point. So my commitment is, and one of the things James is going to work on with me, is to try and smooth that out a little bit and say, right, okay, can we apply a more sensible expected points number if a red card happens in the 30th minute versus the 78th minute, right? And I think that will help to just improve the data set in that regard. It will improve both the Yorkshire Whistler analysis and the impact of the calls that he decides are right or wrong, and it'll improve the quality of the impact analysis that I've done into red cards and penalties that have happened. So not analysing decisions, but just saying there was a penalty awarded here. Given the time, the game state, what was the impact? The penalty bit I'm comfortable with. The red card bit I'm not as comfortable with. So I'm happy to kind of almost try and improve that to make the quality of the analysis better and to address one of the points that James is raising here.
Yeah, and I think the other part... So the other thing to, this goes back to, again, the piece that was written on the Patreon, Graham's Patreon, is, some of these logical fallacies that were appearing. I mean, there are issues with expected points models. There's no question about that. As I said repeatedly on the show, and, you know, any of the people in real life that are unfortunately subjected to spending time with me talking about these things, is all models are wrong, all models are bad, some are more useful than others. This is why I talk endlessly about, it's not about data and stats, it's about analytics and a competency to use these things in a productive way. You know, one of the things that, and again, I'm not being critical of Graham Spears, it's not his domain, but you know, people throw around terms like science and don't really apply it correctly. I mean, science is about the scientific method. It's about a method of inquiry and challenge and creating a structure and a system in order to try and save us from ourselves, because we're all these inherently biased, irrational maniacs, mammals running around on the planet. So that's basically what a robust analytical framework is. It's a cousin of the scientific method. In something like, you know, sports analysis. I mentioned something like weaponizing something. I don't mean that in a sense of, he may not, it's, people don't even realize they're doing it at times because, again, that maybe they're not trained, maybe they're not sophisticated, or maybe they are and they know what they're doing. Like, so it's, you can't really know. But, you know, being coherent and objective is not easy. That's why we have to kind of build these processes, and it's a domain in and of itself. Being self-critical, testing, challenging, knowing that models are not perfect. And that I said down before it went live, it's about being as accurate as you can be, but precision is an unrealistic objective in the vast majority of these endeavors. And so that's, you know, I'll throw a little bit of time in to try and assist Alan with what he's doing. And again, I part of it is I've seen enough with what Alan has been doing, because Alan, probably the first to say, I've been relatively skeptical on some of this stuff at times, particularly when he started it up. I was like, I wouldn't spend my time on this, basically.
Long game, James.
No, I know. And I think that that's, I've seen enough now where it's okay. Some of this is interesting. And it's caused me enough to want to delve in, and not because I think, and this is the other part of this is I think as, someone who spent this amount of time speaking with Alan over the last few years, I view this as very much a, not only good faith, obviously it's coming from a Celtic perspective and an Alan Morrison bias perspective that we all have our own self, obviously. But I think Alan does care about Scottish football broadly and Celtic's place within that. But, that, you know, some of these issues about quality and transparency and culture, it's not just about bias relative to a hypothetical, some people would argue, bias towards one club. So it's about all of these things. And if there's something potentially problematic in this regard, it would be like having this kind of outlier that could be a symptom of match fixing, which we've seen all over the sporting world and particularly European football. And I'm not suggesting anything like that in Scotland. I'm just saying, like, if you had statistical evidence of what was ended up going on with Barcelona, why wouldn't you kind of pursue this? I mean, it's, you know, if you care about integrity of the game and improving certain aspects of it. So that's how I view what you've been doing. Because, and James, quite
sorry, just one other thing as yeah. well is that people misunderstand as well, because they just immediately default to think that this is something to do with football rivalry. This is all about holding the SFA to account. It's about the SFA. It's about the SFA and the way that they manage the service provision of refereeing, and it's about holding power to account in that regard. It's got nothing to do. There happens to be another rival, and that does all add into the sort of, you know, the cultural brew, if you like. But the actual objective is about holding power to account. To your point, it's not about directly about football rivalry, even.
Yeah, and that's how I've kind of viewed it, and this. You know, again, I joked with somebody that this is like this whole topic is like throwing a grenade into a tribal stew, just because, you know, it's so, so easily to do it properly. It requires a fairly extensive amount of analysis and good faith. And by doing that, when you bring a lot to the table, it's easy to take this, that, and the other thing and reconstruct it all around. And because you're not dealing in certainties and you're looking for, you know, potential signals that create more room for inquiry, that kind of thing. But the last thing I'll say, and then we'll close up shop here, is I've never heard any of this being, to kind of support what you just said, Alan, it's never been through the lens of sour grapes or, you know, this is the reason why we lost 10 in a row, any of that kind of nonsense. Like it's mostly been within the context of, you know, what objectively on a domestic basis has been a huge run of success for Celtic. But there's still these weird things that we're seeing in the data, and speaks to some of these issues that, you know, again, I don't think anyone would, or very few people would declare that the quality of what's going on relative to refereeing is at an elite level. So again, back to this concept of the best version of ourselves and striving towards that, you know, that's how we're trying to use some of these tools and really the what expertise we do have in the field of analytics to try and push the ball forward on that. So with that, did you have any final? Nope.
No, I'm done.
Okay, good. Yeah, well, we've been off Twitter for an hour and 15 minutes here, so who knows what's been going on, or X, as we should say. Yes. But for those that have hung in, we appreciate it. We'll be back probably with Enda at some point next week to take a look at the and review the Hearts game. If you can subscribe to YouTube, we'd appreciate that. That helps the channel. And if you can leave a review on your podcast platform of preference, whether it's iTunes or Spotify, we'd appreciate that as well. And we will talk to you next week.